Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If either of you two love Katerina,
leave
shall you have to court her at your pleasure.
Oh, hideous pleasure. Mm. She's too rough for me.
I pray you, father, is it your will to make a whore of me among these mates?
Mates, maid? How mean you that? No mates for you unless you were of milder, gentler mold.
I'faith, sir, you shall have no need to fear. Such mating is not halfway to my heart. But if it were, doubt not my care should be to paint your face and use you like a fool.
Hello and welcome to The Play's the Thing. You have joined us for William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew. This is our Act One discussion, and you just heard a little bit of the 1960s movie starring Elizabeth Taylor as Katerina. The film was directed by Franco Zeffirelli, who also did a version of Romeo and Juliet that we've lauded on the Romeo and Juliet podcasts. I have got a couple of guests with me today who I'm going to introduce. I'm going to introduce Matt Bianco first because a lot of you who have listened to this show have heard Matt a couple of times before. Matt is the COO of the Circe Institute. The Circe Institute is actually the platform provider for this podcast. Matt just finished his PhD work. Last month, Matt, at Faulkner University in the humanities, he and his wife, Patty, have two boys and a favorite. That's what he said. I didn't say that. Matt, welcome back to the show, mister.
Thanks, Tim.
And congratulations.
It's doctor, sir. It's doctor.
Welcome back to the show, doctor. And congratulations on the PhD. That's a major accomplishment. You should be proud.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
We're also joined by a new voice, Nora Ankrum. Nora helped found the West Virginia Shakespeare Festival and Alchemy Theater in Huntington, West Virginia. She's now Alchemy's executive director. When she's not on stage, she is a director for classical conversations, and she has an MA in political theory from Marshall University. And she is the mother to two children, which, Nora, I really like how you worded this in your bio, which you co-created with your husband. I really appreciate that creative copy.
Thank you.
Well done. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. So, you guys, The Taming of the Shrew. This is one that, like, I have not seen The Taming of the Shrew in a long time. And I just jumped back into the text and I started watching a film version of it, the one with Elizabeth Taylor that we just heard, which is actually really good. And it's really like Elizabeth Taylor is this really beautiful kind of classic beauty from the 1950s and 60s. And to have place her as Katerina, I think was like a really wonderful choice. But I kind of want to start actually with like big overall impressions of the play, if you guys are willing to share that before we jump a little bit into the text. Matt, what do you think of Taming of the Shrew? Big picture.
I stupid love it. Like, I love it in ways that probably people shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't love it the way I do. But it's like, I don't know. I think, Tim, in a previous show, you asked me what my Mount Rushmore was for Shakespeare plays. And I don't think Taming of the Shrew made the cut, but it would be really close. Like, it's just outside that the Mount Rushmore. I don't know. I've loved it. I've always loved it from the first time I read it, every time after that, that's not always the case with certain plays or books, right? Like, sometimes I love them, then I read them again, and I hate them, and then I love them again, or I hate them, and then I love them. And this was one that I've loved it every single time.
So what's the thing that keeps drawing you back to it?
But mostly it's the interaction. It's the Petruchio and mm-hmm. Katerina interactions, and just the way all that unfolds. And I don't know. There's just something, I don't know. There's something that I love about it.
But does it make you laugh?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole play. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in the play that makes me laugh, but yeah, those two, their interactions. I think I like that kind of dynamic. I love in, you know, Much Ado About Nothing, I love the interactions between, you know what I'm talking about. I can't remember their names all of a sudden.
And like Beatrice. Yeah.
Yeah. Beatrice. And, like, I love that kind of the displays of wit and, you know, going after each other like that. It's always it's always been interesting to me.
It occurred to me that, this play kind of gets us set up for Petruchio and Kate to meet, you know, like it's the act one is this long setup and we're really eager to get them to meet. And it strikes me as such a similar structure to Much Ado About Nothing. We want Benedict and Beatrice to meet. We're kind of afraid of, at least I am, kind of like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen when they actually meet? It's going to be like a bloodletting or something. And I think Shakespeare does a really good job of getting us to kind of lean forward and say, oh my gosh, I can't wait for them to meet. But we will not see them together on the stage until the next act. And that scene, I have to say, that's one of my favorite, it's maybe my favorite comedic scene in Shakespeare, the two of them together. But we don't really get to it until next week. So hold on, audience. Nora, first impressions of, or your impressions of Taming of the Shrew. What do you think of this play?
Well, if it's possible to be completely opposite, that is how I feel.
don't like the Taming of the Shrew.
I don't, and I really, really want to. So I really hope my mind can be changed. I really want to love it, but I just don't. In fact, I knew it was coming up as an assignment for my students this year, and I had every intention of picking a different Shakespeare. I was going to substitute it.
Are you prohibited, Nora, from taking the Taming of the Shrew out because of the curriculum?
Well, I probably am now that I've said something about it super publicly.
the authorities are listening in.
I just wasn't going to tell anybody.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to tell anybody.
We've blown your cover.
Well, I tell you what happened. We hosted, the West Virginia Shakespeare Festival hosted a series of workshops and lectures this past summer, free to the public. And our keynote speaker, actually, I hadn't spoken to him at all about my distaste for this play. And he brought it up in his keynote address as a play that was widely misunderstood. And he thought, mistreated and should not be rejected so quickly. And I thought, well, there's my rebuke. I've got to figure out what I'm missing about this play.
And do you remember, did the speaker make the case, or was that the sum total of the speaker's case that like it needs to be reconsidered?
Yeah. In the moment that was the sum total. But since then I've been in contact with him and said, all right, help me understand, help me see your point. And, And he's sent me some of his thoughts, and I'm trying to keep those in mind as we read through.
So it sounds like you're kind of doing a little Shakespeare therapy, perhaps, is kind of what's yes. going on. Something like that. Is that right?
Yes.
Nora, tell us why you're not crazy about this play.
So, I mean, on the surface, it seems pretty, well, you know, as an actress, first and foremost, it's not super exciting to think about being tamed,
mm-hmm.
right? The character of Kate starting off as such a strong character and then seemingly ending up as tamed, or I guess mm-hmm. In a little bit more in bondage or brainwashed, or I mean, that's kind of how it appears on the surface to happen. But I agree with Matt about the tête-à-tête and the puns and the language. It's incredibly clever and brilliant, and would be very, very fun to play those scenes. I hope I'm wrong.
Okay.
Play those scenes, but not the final act.
Yeah.
I get it.
So maybe I can, I just want to say as a side note, it's almost as if the host of the plays, The Thing, kind of maybe knew how much the two of you liked and disliked this play, and perhaps maybe brought the two of you on knowing that as a setup for some kind of lively discussion. It's almost as if that has happened.
Wait, are we your Petruchio and...
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I'll take it.
That could be fun. The form seems to fit the content, which is... So
I have one challenge then, to tame Nora. But I didn't do this, Nora. I didn't do this.
It's Tim's fault, Nora. It's completely Tim's fault.
Game on.
Okay, so let me try to give a little bit of a recap of what happens in Act One for the sake of our listeners. I'm actually going to start with the beginning of Act One, even though this play has a preface. It has a two-scene preface that if you have seen any of like the big movies about Taming of the Shrew, you're like, no, Tim, it doesn't have a preface. What it does, and it's a little bit peculiar, and we'll talk about that in a second. But let's just jump right into the play. Our main character is Catherine, or Katarina, who is the shrew. So Kate is the daughter of Baptista Manola. She lives in Padua. She is kind of by reputation... very quick-tempered. She's like prone to violence. She is particularly hostile to anyone who might want to marry her. And we meet also in Act One, Petruchio, who will be her suitor. He's a gentleman from Verona, super egotistical, a little bit eccentric. He's also as quick-witted as she is. He has come to Padua in this great little phrase to wive and thrive. That's kind of his goal. Bianca is the sister of Kate. She's going to figure pretty prominently because she's the opposite of Kate. Very sweet-spoken, unassuming, also beautiful, and also she has a big dowry. So the main kind of crux of the play is Bianca has a large dowry. Kate has a large dowry. The suitors to Bianca cannot marry Bianca if they win her because Kate's older and Baptista wants to marry Kate off first. Okay, so that's like the main crux of this play. So we've got these couple of suitors who show up eager to court Bianca. Father's like, nope. Got to marry Kate off first. And now these two suitors are really eager to go find someone who would actually marry Kate. And they think that this guy, Petruchio, might be kind of like desperate enough to do it. The two suitors' names are Grimio and Hortensio. a little bit older. They're rivals, but they kind of become friends because they keep getting rejected by Bianca. And they're the ones who are really instigating this move to get Petruchio involved with Kate. So I think that's probably enough of a setup for Act One. Let's talk, though, about these peculiar, I'm going to call them the Rip Van Winkle scenes. So we have this character, Sly, Christopher Sly, S-L-Y, who stumbles out of a bar at the very top of the preface of the show, and he's a little bit drunk, and he falls asleep, and he's discovered by these wealthy aristocrats, and they kind of decide they're going to play a joke on him. And so they put him in the, you know, the kind of like the wealthiest aristocrat's home. He wakes up and Christopher Sly is like, where am I? And they start treating him as if he's an aristocrat. And it's actually, I think it's really clever and funny because Christopher Sly is like, I'm not a wealthy man. I'm just a common man. They're like, oh, stop. We know who you are. And it culminates these kind of preface scenes with the performance of the play, The Taming of the Shrew, okay? And like we kind of see Christopher Sly every once in a while going forward, but basically he disappears. So here's my question for each of you. Why? Why did he do this? What is Shakespeare doing here? A preface? He never does a preface. Like maybe sometimes he'll have a monologue. At the beginning of Henry V, he has a monologue. He kind of sets things up. But why? Can you guys like justify the greatest playwright in the world, this strange decision that he made? Nora, come on, tell me.
I don't have a good answer for that. As I was rereading it this last time, I thought maybe I missed something where they came back around to these people at the end and kind of tied it all together, put a button on it. And that doesn't happen. We know that Shakespeare likes the device of the play within the play. And in other cases, he uses it to, I don't know, I'm thinking of the one in A Midsummer Night's Dream, where he uses it to kind of make hyperbole of the characters in the main play. But I don't think we really see that here either.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a good answer. Maybe it is to give distance. Maybe.
Okay. Let me ask another question. If it is to kind of create distance between Shakespeare and his problematic subject matter, does that mean that Shakespeare knows?
Right. Like, is he admitting that this is bad? Right. That was my thought. In fact, when I was thinking about how I would handle it, I thought maybe I could do that. Maybe I could like play into this whole, this is just messing with Christopher Sly. You know, like we know this is absurd. This is absurd. This is as absurd as you being an aristocrat. Right. I don't, I feel like that's probably taking it way too far and definitely undercutting Shakespeare. So I wouldn't let myself do that.
You're saying, Nora, like if you had the opportunity to perform the play, to produce the play, whatever, you've kind of got a little bit of an out. You could perform the preface to the play and kind of create some wiggle room for yourself.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't love it, but yeah. If Matt can't convince me, maybe that's
what. Here we go. Matt, an opportunity.
You say convince, I say tame, whatever. I have a theory that I'll throw out in a second if you want, but yeah. I want to wrestle with the distance question for a second because that one interests me. So there's some cues within the text. There's an essay at the back. I have the folder edition. And there's an essay at the back that goes into this in a little bit more detail. But I wasn't aware of this actually until yesterday. I was on a road trip with my son, my middle son, and I was reading this in preparation for today. And he said, oh, did I ever tell you about the paper I wrote on The Taming of the Shrew back in high school? And he hadn't, or if he had, I don't remember. And he's the middle child. So he's his story.
Not even your favorite.
Easy to forget. Right. Yeah. And so he starts telling me about this. Like he did a report on like the background information for Shakespeare's England when this, at the time this play was written. And so the essay in the back goes into this, but there's a line in act one, in scene one, where, you know, I think it's as, well, I think it's in the clip actually that you played at the beginning. So she's yelling, you know, Katerina's yelling at those guys, right? Gremio and Hortensio. And then Gremio says, I think the father says, leave shall you have to court her at your pleasure. And Gremio says, to cart her rather, she's too rough for me. And then there's a note, you know, about what it means to cart her. But my son apparently wrote a paper on this or did a presentation on this idea of carting her. And he was telling me that in England at that time, whatever, I don't know, but at that time it was common for men to do these kind of public displays of shaming to their wives when they were upset with them. And part
sounds
of them
healthy.
Yeah. Well, right. Bring back carting. Yeah.
just you're kidding, making just my kidding. Case for me.
I know. Right?
Yeah. Right. Right.
I'm doing the opposite of what I'm trying to do here. So they were doing this thing with carting, right. And publicly shaming, and in some cases physically abusing their wives in public. And then I didn't see this in the essay, but my son was telling me that they even had these like contraptions over rivers where it was like the seat that they would strap the wife into. And then the machine would dunk her into the river at the husband's control.
What?
And that's what he said. Yeah. And that sometimes the husbands might be drunk enough or stupid enough that they would hold her under too long and they would, the wife would drown and it would kill them.
What?
Yeah. So he was saying, this is what my son was saying. He thinks that this play is actually Shakespeare going after that practice, right? And that he's trying to correct it. And he's doing so by showing an example of a man who tames his wife without ever laying a hand on her and without ever doing it publicly. That is his entire way of you know, working out the nuances of their relationship is to do it with words, but also to do, or rhetorically, but mostly privately, like in their home. And I mean, although sometimes there are, you know, haberdashers there present or whatever, right?
But, sure, yeah.
But he's doing it basically privately, not parading her through the street and not doing it physically. And that, so Shakespeare's trying to correct this bad practice by offering this alternative that in his day would be a huge leap, right? In right. our day, we might say, whoa, that's still bad. But respect, I mean, with relatively speaking, it was an advancement upon what was happening at the time. That's what my son thinks. And so if my son's point is right, then maybe that's the reason for the distancing, right? Is to challenge the norms of his day without bringing it too close to home, right? Where they couldn't be mad at him, right? Because there's this distance.
We've talked on this show before about what a fine political line that Shakespeare had to walk in his day. I mean, you know, it's easy to look outside in 21st century America and see how politically loaded everything is. And while it is politically loaded and things are really divisive, compared to Shakespeare's day, it's just not even on the same spectrum, you know? And it's almost like a testament to Shakespeare's genius that he stayed alive, that he didn't get thrown in the stocks and was able to actually produce kind of like meaningful theater without offending the wrong people. And he gets in trouble sometimes because people think he kind of equivocates. Like, what is he actually saying in The Taming of the Shrew? You know, he seems pretty equivocal, but things like that are so interesting to me, Matt, that yeah, maybe this is some way of kind of like him keeping his head on his shoulders and also providing some sort of a critique against, like, I just can't believe what you're telling me about carting. Like, do you have any notion of how frequently this is practiced?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know. Enough that they wrote an essay about it in the back of the Folger's edition, enough that he puts a line referencing the practice in the text without any explanation, right? It's just said.
Meaning, so people are going to know what he's talking about.
Right.
Is what you're asserting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. Let's talk about Petruchio, what's he want?
Money. Wiving and thriving.
Wiving and thriving.
Exactly what he says. I don't think he's mincing words there. I think he says what he means. He wants money and he wants a wife.
Nor is there anything more to Petruchio than... I'm asking you to defend the guy that you're probably not the craziest about in the camp.
I'm not the craziest. I wonder if he does start that way. He wants to wive and thrive. But I wonder if he develops. I mean, I think he's got to, right? Or it's not super interesting. And I think he does. I think he does develop somewhat. And I think he does. I think you could probably make a case that he develops an affection or a true affection for Kate, not just to tame her and not just to conquer her, but to honestly have an affection for her. It's still a hard one for me to swallow, especially outside of that context. But I think eventually he does want more than that. I don't know how quickly, though. I'm not sure. I think the first scene where they meet and they first have their back and forth, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Possibly a little bit then.
When he meets a woman who can stand up to him, who can hold her ground with the wit.
Yeah, and then kind of the same for her too, right? Like, this is a guy who's not running from her, who's finally not afraid of her, like her father is and her sister and all of the other men in the town. He actually stands up to her, and they definitely match wits.
It's a different kind of standing up to her too, right? Because Gremio standing up to her is cart her rather, but
yeah, like as I hide behind this thing, I'm going to stand up to you.
Yeah.
But Petruchio standing up to her is not, it's not always derogatory. It's in fact, it's hardly derogatory in that first scene with her, right? It's, I mean, of course we're getting ahead ourselves in the acts, but it's much more complimentary along the way, right?
He decides ahead of time that he's going to compliment her.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's pretty brave of him, especially considering all of the buildup to this meeting, right?
Her reputation precedes her.
Yeah. So it kind of takes maybe a person with a giant ego to enter that room at all.
Does Kate need to be tamed? And I'm asking that. There's a couple of ways that I could ask that. I mean to ask that within the bounds of the play. I don't mean like, does a young woman with a dowry who's too outspoken in, you know, like English society need to be tamed? I'm not asking that. I mean, within the bounds of the play.
No, I think if you read this straightforwardly, she's not a nice person. She certainly needs to be taken down a few notches for sure. I mean, she's manhandling her sister and throwing things, striking people, and she is a viper's tongue. I mean, she's not a nice person at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's not. She's not. She throws a stool at the two suitors of Bianca. Yeah. Like, she comes out roaring from the very top.
Yeah.
So listeners, we are doing this on a Zoom call, and I can actually see Matt and Nora's faces, and I'm noticing, Nora, in the background, you have a Rosie the Riveter poster, right?
I do.
How I'm going to use that as, would you say, Matt?
How perfect.
No, it is. It's perfect. Because it allows me to segue into this little story about, do you guys know the musical Kiss Me, Kate?
Yes.
No.
Have you ever seen Kiss Me, Kate?
I only know the music and the plot line. I haven't seen it.
So Kiss Me, Kate is the story of the Taming of the Shrew. It was put on, it was a huge hit in the 1950s. And I learned a little bit about the background of the musical from this interview that I did with James Shapiro. James Shapiro wrote this book called Shakespeare in a Divided America. And he takes different kind of episodes in Shakespeare performance history. And he talks about how fraught these kind of like political moments were. And in comes a Shakespeare performance. He talked about how Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth were both huge Shakespeare aficionados. And of course, they interpreted him in completely different ways. So it's a great book. I'm actually like plumping the book even as we talk. But what he said about Kiss Me Kate was really fascinating. Kiss Me Kate is a big Broadway musical, and the original idea behind it, of course, the plot line came from The Taming of the Shrew. But the thing that was kind of going on in American culture at the time, think Rosie the Riveter, is that there are all of these women who are holding like really important jobs while sons and husbands were and uncles were away in Europe and in Japan. And now they all these men come back home, and what do they want? Well, they want their wives and mothers back at home. Okay. But these wives and mothers are kind of like, I like my job. I like what I'm doing. I'm not so sure that I'm just like going to come right back home. So what Shapiro said was the whole production of that show is kind of meant to address this kind of friction between the genders that's happening in the United States after World War II. And I thought that was so interesting. I just think that like, I mean, it's part of the reason why I just think Shakespeare is just so delightful and wonderful, because it sounds like such a cliche. He's still speaking to us today, but he really is. You know, he really is. Okay, that's the end of my
commercial. I was actually going to ask that question about more modern versions of the story and where you've seen it and where you've seen it work. And which elements are left in and which are not, right? So in part of my preparation for this play as the really high scholar that I am, I watched the 90s classic 10 Things I Hate About You, which is also a retelling of The Taming of the Shrew.
But, okay, so how do they do it, Nora, in 10 Things I Hate About You?
Padua is the name of the high school, which is pretty fun. And then Kat and Bianca are the sisters, and Patrick is Petruchio, and it's high school. So it's, you know, silliness. But yeah, she's a shrew, and the sister is not allowed to date until the older sister dates. And the guy that wants to date Bianca pays a big tough guy, gets around paying. There are several suitors involved for Bianca, and they pay a guy to take out Cats, and he ends up falling for her, and you know, it's a rom-com in the 90s. So
who plays the lead?
Julia Stiles is Cat.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And Heath Ledger, yeah, he plays Patrick or Petruchio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, very fun. Nice. Very nice. I've never seen it. Maybe I should, and it was like part of my preparation. Matt.
There's a John Wayne movie where he moves back to Ireland. He's a boxer, I think. And he's like, I can't remember the name of it. But he's a boxer, and then something happens and he can't box anymore. So he has to go back to Ireland. And then he meets a girl there. That's Kate, and he has to tame her. And it's one of those movies that, like, I don't know. I like the movie, but I don't like what it does with Taming of the Shrew, because he's much more physical and aggressive.
Really?
It's like kind of, but it's like presented as if that's normal, you know?
Uh-huh.
And maybe, I don't know, back in the 50s or something, you know, probably it was to some extent, I don't know, but I don't like it. He feels a little bit too aggressive to me. I mean, I like it as a movie, but I don't like it as like a way of human interaction, male, female human interaction, you know? So that's a tough.
So if you're going to tell the story, I guess now, as I'm planning to in the spring, actually, are we saying that you definitely have to set it in the time period in which it is written, and really truly establish that world for this kind of message or device to really work?
I think that's a great question. I think it's almost like, Nora, isn't it like the first production question of anyone who like takes the dilemma of this play seriously?
Yeah.
What do we do?
Right. Like, how do we do this? Because, you know, I've been in several Shakespeare's, and some of them have been traditionally set, but a lot of times we set them in different time periods or different settings. You know, we did Twelfth Night, and we set it in an island resort, Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville style. It was super fun. It made it a lot of fun. Or like a contemporary Julius Caesar political campaign, things like that. But I don't know how you do that with Shrew. I don't know how you do that outside of the context in which it's written, you know?
The Elizabeth Taylor movie that we heard at the top of the show is very deliberately set back then.
Yeah.
And so in a way it kind of, I don't know, it puts a safety seal on the play. You know, you can say, oh my gosh, it's so shocking, but that's back then. That's the way that it was back then. I think if you're going to set it in a contemporary fashion, you've got like a few choices. So maybe one of the choices is, spoiler alert, Kate and Petruchio get together and Kate is kind of tamed. There's a way in which you could do it, maybe, Nora, I want to know what you think about this, where Kate's winking at the audience.
Yeah, I thought about that. And I thought about even the two of them winking at the audience together, the two of them coming to sort of a mutual understanding. And in the end, you know, they're the only couple of the three that are really truly in love, that really have come to an understanding of one another. And it's because of this battle of wits, or this, you know, back and forth taming of, maybe even taming of one another. But I don't know if that really honors the text or not. I'm not sure.
I don't know that. I wouldn't necessarily take that path myself, because I have a different way of approaching it. But there is a scene, there is a line in Act Two that I think could give you the privilege there, or the credence.
The out I'm looking for. Good.
Yeah, because, I want to hear this.
Yeah, me too.
I'm curious.
I'm taking notes.
When Petruchio and Kate have their back and forth, their one-on-one after Petruchio talks to Baptista, right? So Act Two, Scene One. Then they come back to the group, and he's telling Baptista what happened, but everybody's there: Grant, Remio, Tranio, whatever. And then Petruchio says, in Act Two, Scene One, all the way down to line 321 and down, he says, "Be patient, gentlemen. I choose her for myself. If she and I be pleased, what's that to you? 'Tis bargained twixt us twain, being alone, that she shall still be cursed in company." And so there's a line there that says they agreed privately beforehand that when they're together in public, they will have this interaction, but when they're privately, they won't. Now, we saw their private conversation, so we know, I mean, unless something got left out, we know that's not necessarily true. Right. But he says that there, and I'm pretty sure she's present in that moment, and she doesn't deny it, which is something she's certainly capable of having done.
So Matt, can I say this back to you to see if I understand? What you're saying is, they kind of agree there's going to be public and private for them as a couple. Privately, they can be in love, but publicly they're going to kind of continue to kind of like perform this charade of their older selves. They're going to be antagonistic with each other. And so what you're saying is the conclusion of the play could look something like Kate publicly, you know, being tamed, while at the same time winking to Petruchio, you know better.
Right.
Yeah.
They start out one way and then they flip it at the end, right? Uh-huh. For the public behavior.
Yeah. I would love for that to be the case. I don't know if I can stretch it that far.
Nora, if it is the case, okay, I mean, like, I'm going to take up your cause. If it is the case, then you're kind of aren't you kind of giving into this kind of like public acquiescence that it's okay?
Yeah.
The taming is okay?
Well, the scene at the end that I'm thinking of, where they're in, you know, where they're in agreement, all the husbands, and maybe I'm jumping too far ahead. but all the husbands call for all the wives and none of them come except Kate. And that's the proof. And that's the, and he, and it's the fulfillment of a bet, right, between the three husbands. So, I mean, you could play it like, she's in on it too. She's just as mercenary as he is at that point. And she's helping him win the bet. And, but she's willingly doing it, not like she has no more brain. But I don't know. I mean, like you said, in that scene between the two of them, I feel like we would have had to have seen something there. So unless there's a lot of acting happening between those lines,
it is curious though, why she doesn't correct him when he says it.
Like, I agree. I agree with that. Is it because she's not quiet?
Yeah, right. She's not quiet before then or after. So is it because it's true, or another possibility is that she wants this?
Mm.
I think that is a possibility too. I think that maybe they're both struck with each other in that conversation. I mean, it happens pretty fast, but that's not unusual for Shakespeare.
Not at all, right?
Not at all. And it's at least slower than Bianca.
Right. I don't trust you. I love you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I saw a production of Much Ado About Nothing, and I'm going to give a brief recount of the plot of that play, which is such a great idea. I'm going to take us totally out of this play and into another play. There's a kind of Benedict and Beatrice are the main couple, and there's the secondary set of characters, Claudio and Hero, in Much Ado About Nothing. Claudio is fooled into believing that Hero is cheating on him, and on their wedding day, he publicly shames her in front of everybody. She's completely innocent, completely shames her. And that, I think, happens in Act 3, halfway through the play. And then at the end of the play, Benedict and Beatrice get married, and so do Hero and Claudio. But it's like really unsettling. You're like, wait, Hero got completely humiliated publicly on her wedding day by Claudio, and now she's just going to kind of get together with him and everything's going to be okay? Really? This is really going to work? So I saw it at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. What they did was they kind of like took us all the way up to the wedding scene. They had Benedict and Beatrice get together, of course, but then they had, in the very final kind of snapshot of the play, Hero and Claudio are on opposite sides of the stage, and you can tell, you can see on Hero's face, this is never going to work. And so the ending of the play is very bittersweet. It's not a reunion between two couples, but it's one couple gets together and the other couple actually kind of like is, we know they're going to kind of play out the damage done in Act 3. I thought it was fabulous. I thought it was so fabulous because it didn't gloss this kind of horrible event. That's really, it's for me, it's really hard to forgive Claudio for that. I'm like, man, that's like an insurmountable obstacle you just set up. So I really appreciate contemporary, not every contemporary telling, but contemporary tellings that kind of deal with the subject matter faithfully and yet in some way acknowledge things have changed. In a lot of ways, things have changed in really positive ways since Shakespeare wrote these things. So I think during the course of these podcasts, hopefully we can talk about different opportunities that we might see in the text to kind of, I don't know, play the Taming of the Shrew in a way that is both faithful, but maybe a little bit more, what is the word that I'm looking for?
Palatable.
Palatable. Gentle, something like that.
You know, so what you're saying though, there's something to that about like the importance of obviously seeing other people play with the text, right, and play with their characters. And I remember reading this with high schoolers, 11th graders, and they read the play and they thought, there's no way that can be overcome, right? I'm still talking about Much Ado About Nothing. Sorry. There's no way that the damage between Claudio and Hero could be overdone.
Yeah.
Overcome. Then we watched the Kenneth Branagh version, which has that guy from House, from the TV show House.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name, that actor. That guy's a horrible actor. And everything he's ever done, he's horrible. I don't know why anybody.
Wait, really? He's bad.
He's bad. And he plays that part. And it's completely unbelievable that he meant it. That he meant any sort of repentance, right? Because he's such a bad actor. And yet, because the lines just don't allow for it, you know, whatever. And then it ends like as if it's all been overcome, right? And so it's Kenneth Branagh's version doesn't deal with it either way. It doesn't give you a believable repentance, nor does it give you some way of reckoning with that, right? That I saw, that I noticed, that I caught. And it further convinced my students that the play's a failure, right? Because it's not.
Can't be done.
It can't be done, right? Then we went to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts or something like that in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we saw a live production of it there. And I don't know who that kid was. I don't know what his name was, what the actor was, nothing. But it was the most convincing, most believable scene of repentance I've ever seen in my entire life. And I became absolutely convinced that it was possible.
Wow.
For there to be genuine reconciliation there because of the actor.
Wow.
And the way he pulled it off. So that's the thing, right? Like I read it with my kids and I thought, it's not believable. It's not genuine repentance. It's not believable repentance because I couldn't imagine myself repenting in that way as believably, right? And then I saw an actor do it, couldn't see it there, but then I saw another actor do it who was able, and I don't know. I thought it was pretty brilliant. So I mean, the same sort of thing could be coming up here too, right? With these in every play, right? Where something looks like it's happening too fast, right?
That's true.
It's hard to say how genuine the interaction might be. But the actors orbit with the people, you know, the actual Petruchio and Katerina, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you don't embrace all of it, I mean, truly embrace all of it, you certainly do a disservice, I think, to the author, but also you miss the opportunity to really discuss the implications, the cultural moment, all of those things, by trying to gloss over it too much, right? Or by trying to make it less than what it is, less severe. So yeah, I wouldn't want to do that for sure.
You guys, I feel like we've done a good job of kind of like opening up the problems of the play. And let's be honest, act one is set up. I mean, there's wonderful lines. Even those first two scenes with Christopher Sly, I think they're clever. But I think that the real fireworks of The Taming of the Shrew begin in act two. So I'm going to say, let's consider our job done for act one. We've opened up the problems of the play. And the next time we record, we're going to dig in a little bit more to the characters and the plot and the themes that Shakespeare is establishing. So I want to thank both of you guys. I want to thank our audience for joining us for act one. Matt, you got something else, mister?
Well, just a question.
Yeah, please.
I mentioned earlier that I have another theory about the induction besides the distancing.
Do you want to talk
about that today, or do you want to save that for the next?
I'd like to hear it today. Could you set it up for us?
Okay. So, since brevity is the soul of wit, I want to say Shakespeare says.
Yes.
I'll see if I can be brief here, but there's a great line in Hamlet, a line that I love in Hamlet, where Hamlet tells his mother, assume the virtue if you have it not. I wonder if this play is not I as the person am assuming a virtue that I do not have, but rather the flip side is I am treating somebody with a virtue that they do not have. And in the Hamlet play, the idea is if I assume the virtue that I do not have, then I will come to
kind of conform to
virtue, right? And so the idea here is what if I assume a virtue in another person, then they begin or assume a certain quality in another person, then they begin to live that out, right? So there's a sense in which if Disney does this a lot with princess movies, right? You take this girl and she's like an uneducated, unkempt, unsophisticated, whatever, American. And then you go put her in this, in she finds out she's actually a princess, and you go put her in this castle in some made up country in Europe. And then suddenly she begins acting and behaving and being a queen, right? So I wonder if there's something like that going on, right? The induction scene begins with a guy who's a piece of garbage, for lack of a better term. And then they treat him like a lord. And he begins embracing that pretty quickly.
This is so interesting.
Right?
That's where you're going.
Then the Taming of the Shrew then is a play put on for him, showing that happening in others. And so then he, Petruchio, treats Kate like somebody who is a good, loving wife. And she begins acting like a good, loving wife. Mm. And he treats her in ways that her father never does, right? I think we could talk about this as we go on.
Oh, that's true.
I'll flesh out the theory. But the father, Baptista, I think, abuses her. And I think in every place that Petruchio appears to be abusing her, he's actually showing her more love in that area than her father ever did. But we'll flesh all this out.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
So I think that Petruchio is treating her like she needs to be treated. But then he starts acting, in doing so, he begins acting like a loving husband, which then turns him into a loving. So he's then assuming the virtue that he doesn't have. And then it turns him into that kind of a virtuous person, right? And then I think you could see this kind of fleshed out in positive and negative regards with a lot of the different characters. So I think that might be what's going on, right? They're treating Christopher Sly in that way. And then they're presenting him with a play where that is happening with all the characters.
I really like that. Especially in, definitely want to flesh that out more as we go throughout the play. Cause there are some places where I'm not sure it works, but I like it mostly because it's the players acting as, well, Petruchio is the players then, right? So they are the ones, we are here, we are teaching you this lesson, we are showing you this thing. So it doesn't have to be virtuous or not. It doesn't have to be pure or not, right? It's, I mean, like you could argue that these people have like kidnapped this drunk guy and they're kind of abusing him a bit, right? And maybe it's for his own good, maybe whatever, but, you don't have to make all of those same judgments then if they are the Petruchio or Petruchio is them, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that really well.
Yeah.
I will tell you this though, if you need an out from it, and there's probably plenty to find, but I will tell you this, that I did a class on justice and we had to read this play for an example of domestic justice. This is pulled straight from, what's his name? Mortimer Adler's, the great books, The Synopticon. Is it Mortimer? Yeah. The Synopticon. Right. Anyways. So we had to read this play as an example of domestic justice. And then I had to write a paper on it. And in my paper, I made this argument for this idea. I don't remember talking about the induction very much, but it was mostly about this idea of like treating somebody the way, a certain way, and then they become that. And my professor wrote his note on it afterwards was, I've never heard this theory before. This is, you completely made this up. Nobody's ever talked about it in this way before. I have no idea where you got this from, whatever, but you know, here's your grade. Basically like, this is the most novel, innovative thing I've ever heard. And it doesn't belong in writing. Well, essentially was what he said. Although he gave me a good grade on it, but yeah.
But he did give you a good grade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you call it fake it till you make it?
Yeah. Fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
Virtue concepts in Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew.
That's good.
You guys, I want to close the show with a song from Kiss Me, Kate. I'm not going to even name it, but I am going to tell you who it's by. Cole Porter wrote the song. I want to thank both of you for joining me on the show. As always, everybody, you can find us and participate in our discussion by joining the Close Reads discussion page on Facebook. And we'd love to hear from you there. please join us next week for Act Two. And until then, enjoy Cole Porter's... Well, I'm not going to name the song. Just enjoy the song.
Just remember what the immortal bard once said. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Unquote. So remember this.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry. So to win their hearts, you must quote with these Aeschylus and Euripides. But the poet of them all, who will start them simply raven, is the poet people call the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Brush up your Shakespeare, start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow. Just declaim a few lines from Othello, and they'll think you're a heck of a fella. If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what pony called Cleopatra. And if still to be shocked she pretends well, just remind her that all's well
that ends well. Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all kowtow.